Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Welcome. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. I'm your host, Milind Mahiri, CEO and founder of Yield Street. And today I'm joined by Kevin Mirabal, author and professor at Fordham University. Kevin recently released his latest book, Exotic Alternative Investment, Standalone Characteristics, Unique Risks, and Portfolio Effects, which highlights Yield Street along with a few of our leaders like Cynthia Sachs, MD of Art Finance, and Ron Suber, Yield Street board member. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Milind. Very happy to be here.
So for those watching that are unfamiliar, Kevin is a clinical associate professor of finance at Fordham University. He teaches courses on the principles of finance, investment analysis, derivatives, and alternative investing. Prior to becoming an academic, he's held senior executive roles at Morgan Stanley, Barclays, and Large Lane Advisors in banking and asset management. And he did a lot of work in securities, derivatives, security financing, and hedge fund investing. Kevin received his BS in accounting from SUNY Albany, MS in banking and finance from Boston University, and his doctorate in finance and economics from Pace University. Kevin, that's quite an interesting background. Did I miss anything?
No, you got it very well, Milind. Thank you. Yeah, I'm very grateful to have had the opportunity to see the world from both a commercial and an academic perspective.
Yes, Kevin, you indeed have an amazing background. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you get started on Wall Street?
Sure. Well, initially, I was an accounting and economics major when I graduated from SUNY Albany. I became a CPA, and I was working on a number of banks and financial services and investment partnerships while I was in public accounting. But shortly thereafter, I joined Morgan Stanley and later Barclays Capital based on my interest in financial services. It was a dynamic industry, fast-paced. It was a meritocracy, so it afforded opportunity. My focus was on operationally intensive and finance intensive businesses and servicing our active trading clients, those using derivatives and some of the earliest hedge funds. I was fortunate to work in New York, London, and Tokyo for a US investment bank, a UK commercial bank, and a Japanese securities firm. And I ended my Wall Street career after having operated as a chief operating officer first for a hedge fund, and then for an alternative asset management firm.
That's awesome, Kevin. Congratulations. And you have an amazing background, especially at a time when, 1990s and 2000s saw some really biggest growth in Wall Street. So tell us a little bit about your transition to academia.
Sure. You know, personally, I always believed in education as a means to sell, particularly on Wall Street, selling complex products, but also as a tool to nurture, attract, and grow staff. You know, education is a medium that pays a very high dividend and a high return on investment. While I was at Barclays, I was fortunate enough that when the firm wanted to try to increase its brand awareness at a lot of the top universities in the United States, they asked me to go onto campuses and at first guest lecture, and then later serve as an adjunct professor. And so I sort of got hooked on the whole concept of educating young people and academic perspectives. After my doctorate from Pace, I was able to qualify to teach full time, and I joined the Gabelli School of Business in 2011, where I'm the director of the Alternative Investment Program. Somewhat uniquely, we offer undergraduates courses in real estate, venture capital and private equity, hedge funds, and other alternatives. I still do some advising and consulting and serve as a trustee for some mutual funds.
That's great. So you obviously mentioned alternatives, and that's really the topic of this webinar, Kevin. So the real burning question is, why alternatives? Why did you choose to focus on that?
Well, somewhat early in my career, someone, and I don't remember who, suggested that I seek out complexity and become a subject matter expert. Now, the way to kind of get ahead on Wall Street was to make yourself valuable to others. So early in my career, I became a subject matter expert on equity and bond portfolio financing, listed derivatives, and was introduced to alternative investment funds and some of their unique business models and counterparty exposures. Eventually, I doubled down on alternatives as my domain expertise. I found that these structures were different, seemingly more complex, not so well understood, and the people were really fun and interesting to work with. So during my buy-side career, both as a CEO of a hedge fund and an asset management firm, I was responsible for overseeing things like due diligence and managing our investments counterparty risk. I got to appreciate a bit of the creative thinking that was present in the alternative space. And it also was an area that leveraged my Wall Street experiences, because investing in various alternatives takes a 360-degree view. You have to be conversant not just in the value proposition, but also in some of the logistics and execution risk associated with many alternative investments. And then academically, because there aren't many undergraduate programs that teach classes on alternatives, I found myself excited to be at Gabelli, where the students were really motivated to learn about the various alternatives. And I enjoy giving back to hopefully the next generation of our future leaders in all things alternative.
That's super exciting, Kevin. I think our audience are excited about listening about your book and your finding, but for the sake of clarity, how do you define the phrase exotic alternative investments?
Yeah, that's a great question. Took a lot of thought in preparing for the book and in how I teach to decide how to organize this fairly vast world of opportunities. And the way I do it is I break exotic alternative investments down into principally four buckets. The first are real assets like art and collectibles, things that have a finite supply, no cash flow, and offer appreciation to investors. Mm-hmm. The second group are financial contracts like life insurance, commercial litigation, royalties, things like pandemic bonds. These offer predictable or estimatable cash flows and a defined payoff at maturity. So in many ways, they're like fixed income instruments. Mm-hmm. Then the third category are hybrid assets like farmland, water, air rights, cannabis, homeopathic and genomic medicines. These are things that are self-generating, things that you grow or invent, and they offer both cash flow and appreciation to the investor. And then finally, this last category are businesses or asset classes that have been enabled by disruption or deregulation. These are things like esports and online gaming and gambling, or crypto assets like Bitcoin. You know, these groupings uniquely offer both non-correlated returns and breakout upside if the thesis and the investor vision is fully realized.
I really love, Kevin, how you have really compartmentalized these four assets. It actually makes a lot of logical sense. I think for us at Yield Street, we also obviously simply put alternatives is stuff that you would do outside the traditional stock market, right? And then they come in various different flavors, and you really characterize them really well for us in those four different flavors. Now, obviously, 10 months into this global pandemic, we could not have asked for, in some ways, a better timing with regards to the release. Personally, my view is that alts are going mainstream, and 2021 and beyond is really going to be where alts kind of take center stage. What made you want to write about this topic and some of the asset classes that you cover in the book?
Well, I guess my motivation really comes from a desire to help investors, students, and even other academics kind of understand this ongoing promise of alternative investments as a source of return enhancement and portfolio diversification. In many previous articles and my earlier book on hedge fund investing, I've written in a format and a structure to try to simply, in plain language, explain these asset classes because they offered attractive relative returns, low correlation, strong risk-adjusted performance. You know, once upon a time, that was what hedge funds, real estate, and private equity delivered. Not so much today. You know, returns are down, risk is up, and correlations have converged in many cases. So today I felt that we needed to look beyond traditional alternatives to find these characteristics that they once provided. It also came from this curiosity to better understand a lot of these asset classes and investment ideas that were developed in some of my student research. In the course that I teach on alternative investments, some of the students promoted ideas like investing in luxury handbags and investing in air rights or water rights. So I was curious about how they operated and whether they were really ready for prime time, or at least for high net worth individuals and family offices. I always wanted to offer readers a holistic understanding of some of the value drivers, benchmarks, and risk factors, and kind of a way to get exposure across this wide range of seemingly complex and exotic investments. And one of my goals was to provide a standard framework of analysis that could be applied across this wide and diverse range of asset classes so they could be compared to one another and thought about perhaps on a portfolio basis.
And I think you mentioned portfolio and diversification and non-correlation a couple of times. We are strong believers that the 60-40 portfolio is somewhat dead. It actually mattered 50, 60 years ago. But if you think about how institutional investors or family offices invest, they have 57% allocation to alternatives. If you compare that with retail, they only have 5% correlation. So some of the smartest, brightest investors in the world have 10 times more correlation, Kevin, to alternatives than a typical retail portfolio. And then obviously the other aspect is, you know, for the last couple of years, stock market is at all-time high, the US Treasury is under 1%. And so I think that's really where we feel that alternatives come into play. And the modern investing portfolio should have alternatives as a part of kind of the uncorrelated components to equities and bonds and can help mitigate some of that risk in the portfolio. And then obviously, our view also is that private markets such as private debt and equity may offer excess returns compared to public markets. So I'm just curious on your take about, you know, if you think about one has to modernize their portfolio, what do you think about that?
Well, I totally agree with your position and your thought. Here are a couple of reasons why. I mean, if you think about, you know, with zero interest rates as a lower bound, bonds obviously are at a peak price, and they really don't offer the kind of hedge to equities they once did, nor do they provide any income.
Right.
Peak valuation of stocks, yeah, it means a potential for a large correction and volatility in the future, even if we hopefully have a period of extended gains to the upside. When I think about exotic alternatives or any alternatives, they're supposed to really add value as both a hedge and as a source of income. And some of the exotics that we've been discussing can provide a hedge because of their low correlation to the stock market. Things like esports, farmland, cannabis, they're not really driven by the same kind of trends that traditional stock holdings are driven by. And then there are things like lending against art, which you're very familiar with, or vintage motorcycles or automobiles, self-storage units and shipping containers, and other private credit structures that could provide income. So when I think about these exotic alternatives, I see them fitting in as portfolio diversifiers and income generators. And what's interesting is today, there are more products and structures available, platforms available for the high net worth or even retail investor to start to access some of these products. I would say there is a liquidity trade-off that you have to be mindful of, that these investments, while they may come with higher risk-adjusted returns or better yields, but they also require you to have at least a medium-term or intermediate-term outlook. They're not overnight trades, nor should they be. But nor are they long-term investments that require holding periods associated with private equity, for example. So I do totally agree with your proposition, and I do think we will see more and more allocation, and at least research and due diligence into the alternative space going forward.
Yeah, I think, Kevin, we definitely agree. And I think you made an important point about liquidity. I think sometimes we pay a tremendous premium for liquidity in the stock market. And, generally, I think a consumer should think about really kind of bucketizing their portfolio and then kind of making a liquidity split based on how their portfolio looks, right? I think having 100% liquidity may be too much. Having 20% liquidity may be too little. And so if you can kind of balance that dynamic, then you can obviously really enhance your portfolio and get kind of the risk-adjusted return, which is typically what institutions or a family office would do as they're allocating their capital. The other aspect, obviously, we have to keep in mind is what are your real needs, right? Like, do you want kind of income generation as part of your ongoing portfolio? Or really, are you looking for capital preservation? Or are you really looking for, expanding your assets as, you might have 5, 10, 20 years into your retirement and, really building up that nest egg? So again, I think goals really drive some of the investment strategies that are available to most consumers, and they should really think along those angles. So now, obviously, there has been a evolution in alternative investments. Can you maybe opine a little bit on what are the trends you're seeing in these asset classes and some of their unique value proposition? I think you've touched on some of them, but what are the trends that are really driving some of this adoption?
I mean, what's kind of exciting is there's a number of different trends that are coming together in this space. So you have some of the dynamics of global wealth creation, changes in consumer behavior, population growth, individual mobility, and even things like social justice and deregulation, and certainly technology. So here are a couple of examples. Collectibles are growing, really as a function of global wealth creation. There are many segments of our global population who are in fact increasing wealth, even during times of recession. And these asset classes are in demand. So as tastes and preference shift, you have investors in Europe and in Asia who are interested in U.S. nostalgia. You have U.S. investors who are interested in antiquities from other parts of the world. And many of these collectibles have a fixed supply. So whenever you have a fixed supply, growing demand, and the asset class is traded in dollars, you end up with this unique situation where you have an inflation-protected investment that also benefits from these near-zero interest rates. Collectibles tend to rise in value during periods of low real interest rates. And you could see evidence of this by some of the record auction prices that have occurred this year. Recently, a 1952 Mickey Mantle baseball card traded for $5.2 million. And there's a number of other examples from the art world and other places. Things like esports are really leveraged by the changes in how people consume entertainment. Part of it was COVID-19 related, but this investment provides people with a form of recession protection. You shelter in place, you stay home and play video games. People are finding new ways to be entertained. And perhaps many people think these new forms of entertainment are going to last well beyond the life cycle of this current pandemic. storage units and shipping containers are benefiting from a surge in people moving to online purchases and needing to move goods from places where they're manufactured to places where they're wanted. Also, social mobility. People are moving from one location. People from California are moving to Texas. People from New York are moving to Florida. The demand for shipping containers and storage units are at all-time highs. And what's interesting about those investments is they kind of act like floating rate bonds because they generate rents against the purchase price that are variable in nature. Semi-annual or annually, those yields adjust as the rents get repriced. So you kind of end up picking up this extra yield on a floating rate instrument relative to what you might see in a publicly traded security, and you still get appreciation. Things like life settlement contracts, they leverage the need for people who are aging in our society to improve their personal liquidity. There are many segments of the population that have life insurance policies, but perhaps don't have enough cash flow to maintain their living style. When an investor buys a policy, you're in fact putting money into the hands of people who need it, increasing their liquidity to fund their own longevity. And in that case, you end up owning an asset that's effectively a receivable from a AAA credit, an insurance company. Yet your return looks like high yield. So there are many other trends, like things like global population shifts. As you see China and other markets like India change their habits and their diets, demand for certain foodstuffs are increasing. So investing in farmland that grow row crops or investing in water rights in order to own interest in the water that's needed to grow crops are seeing very strong positive up cycles. And then things like cannabis and Bitcoin, you know, they're obviously benefiting from deregulation and changing social values. And I think just to sum it up, you know, all of these exotics do share this common value driver, which is a low correlation and a high Sharpe ratio. Now, Malin, let me ask you a question. You're very well much invested in this space and are an expert in alternatives yourself. You know, what do you think is motivating people or enabling people today to seek out alternative investments?
Alternative investments, and obviously not to repeat too much, is a great complement to the portfolio. And we always, you know, knew that because of the example I gave about institutions having so much exposure to them, right? So let's leave that aside. You know, I think that's a great asset class that is non-correlated. But then broadly, to answer your question as to why people are adopting, I think our consumer behavior in the last decade changed quite a bit with mobile and technology. We became different consumers. We had an app for everything. And if you think what role technology played in all this, or technology company played in all this, just look at market caps. 2010, there were three companies that were top 10 in the world in terms of market cap. Exiting the decade, seven out of the top 10 companies were tech companies. And so I think this whole trend of democratization is not just cliche. What has happened is consumers become smarter. They know how to interact with content. And no longer is there a case where somebody in a nice suit is going to call you, you know, throw a 100-page PPM and convince you to buy a product from a financial institution. You need to meet the consumer where they want. And you're seeing that in the last few years with the rise of robo-advisors, with the rise of challenger banks. And now, as I mentioned, alts are going mainstream. So if you think about all platforms like Yield Street, as well as a number of real estate platforms, and you mentioned collectibles, there are, you know, platforms like Masterworks and Rally Road that are all getting traction, because what consumers want is what institutions had. But they are not going to be in a position to, you know, spend hours and hours. So you really have to use the technology. Make sure, by the way, right information is in front of them. They really understand the risks and the rewards. But if you can reach them at the place that they're there, that's the experience that they want. And in my opinion, this is going to lead us into the next decade, which I feel is going to be the golden age of fintech, which is 2020 to 2030. And you're going to see a lot more engagement from the consumer. And this is all obviously accelerated, Kevin, because of the pandemic. I mean, think about the Robinhood user base. A lot of people were home. A lot of millennials were home. And they literally went from couple million accounts at the beginning of the year to 15 million accounts because people started trading quite a bit. So that democratization of finance and democratization of investing is already in full steam. And because of some of the fantastic overview that you gave, Kevin, with regards to kind of benefits of alts and what people think about alts, that's what is driving the consumer into thinking of alts as something that should be part of their portfolio, in my opinion. So that's really what I think about it.
You know, that sort of explains the proliferation of seemingly easy to access ways to get exposure to these newer, more exotic asset classes. You'd be surprised to find out, and if you read my book, you'll certainly find out, but you'd be surprised to find out the number of public companies, ETFs, exchange-traded trusts, niche hedge funds that actually offer exposure. I mean, you can buy an ETF that trades on the New York Stock Exchange to get exposure to esports. You can buy a publicly listed company to get exposure to litigation funding. These are seemingly esoteric segments of the market that offer liquid and available structures to investors. And then this whole concept of fractional ownership of farmland, artwork, collectibles, and the proliferation and expertise in financing them, like the Yield Street platform, is, I guess, making it easier for people than ever before to access what I would have thought would have been a more complex, longer lead time transaction. So I'm very encouraged by what you said.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So Kevin, in some ways, 2020, when it comes to alternatives, and as you said, you know, you kind of classified crypto as one of your four buckets of like kind of the disruptive areas, right? And it would be remiss for us to not mention crypto because they really had one of the best years since their inception in the last decade or so. So what's your view on crypto market in general, and obviously the surge in Bitcoin pricing and you know what's happening with DeFi and all that? So love to hear some thoughts there.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because dealing with students and the younger generation, I'm constantly presented with the question, you know, where does crypto fit in? Should I buy Bitcoin with my student loans? And all sorts of interesting discussions. Where I come out on this is that crypto is still very much a trader's market. Most people are making money in the short run by getting in and out. You know, recently we've seen some large corporate balance sheets like Tesla and some others decide to hold Bitcoin. And of course, there's these anecdotal stories like an NFL player choosing to get paid in Bitcoin rather than in dollars. But the usage case for Bitcoin as a currency is still not anywhere near being realized. It's not widely accepted. It's not readily serving as a cash alternative. And until we see aggressive expansion of its use as a currency and institutional buying Bitcoin as a store of value or safe haven, I think it's going to remain a trader's and not an investor's market. You know, look, if it realizes its full potential and its theoretical value as a replacement for the US dollar, one Bitcoin would be worth $500,000. I don't see that happening in my lifetime, primarily due to the unwillingness of central banks to give up control of their currency to a distributed ledger or global platform. But what I do believe will happen is I think some central banks, and I believe one or two have done this already, will adopt a digital currency to replace their fiat money. So I could see a world where you have a digital dollar, but it is regulated and controlled and monitored by the Federal Reserve. So those are my thoughts. Only time will tell where Bitcoin comes out as a part of a true investment portfolio.
Yeah, I think I agree with some of your observation. And Kevin, if I may add, I think there are some real use cases for crypto as well as for blockchain, which is the underlying technology, right? And I think if you think about money transfer or if you think about interchange fees, you know, I think those are the types of things that could be really disrupted if you have digital currency that can really securely be transmitted, and you have ability to like really control it. I think stable coins provide some of the characteristics that you mentioned with regards to countries adopting, you know, digital currency. But I think one big change for 2020 is that broadly large financial institutions really started talking openly about their support for cryptocurrency, which is why, you know, we are seeing really big adoption here. So yes, I think we can obviously have a complete podcast or a webinar on crypto. There is so much of interesting stuff happening there. So before we kind of come to a conclusion, obviously both of us are extremely passionate about investing and the idea of providing investors with access to alternative investment. So one final point I kind of wanted to ask you, if you were to sum up all of your research, what do you think the future holds for the alternative markets? Like, where do we go in the next, I would say 3 to 5 years?
I think the traditional alternatives like hedge funds, private equity, and real estate will continue to gather assets. I think that they will still fulfill some of their original promise, but to a lesser degree. Returns will be muted, volatility will be higher, but they still will deliver portfolio diversification. I think some of these more complex, less understood asset classes will grow. I think that despite these opportunity sets, though, I think the ability for these more exotic asset classes to expand and grow and draw in investors will be limited by the infrastructure, the due diligence, and the education that's available around these asset classes. So I think in the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see more growth, but we're going to see growth as a function of education and as a function of familiarity. And there are a number of these asset classes that are suffering from a lack of capital. And as long as investors do the homework, I think they'll be attracted. I believe there's a bright future for alternatives, but it's not without risk, and investors need to be cautious and just put in the time.
I couldn't agree more. And what you said is obviously, music to our ears, because, that's part of our core, thesis at Yield Street of how to really take alts mainstream. But I think you have to have a holistic view, make sure that your portfolio is diversified, not only within alts, but within your overall portfolio in terms of liquidity, duration, cash flow, all of your needs. And so I think that is something that is absolutely critical for us. I think the fact of the matter that we are having, you wrote this book and we are having this webinar, gives me a lot of confidence that alts are obviously here to stay. And they were always here, right? A lot of institutions did this for last several decades. And the moment for alts to go mainstream is now finally here because of changes to regulation, some trends that you spoke about, Kevin. So really interesting conversation. Your book is very, very comprehensive. I would urge all the listeners to go obviously check it out. So before we close with how they can find you, I wanted to have a little fun and talk a little bit about over under, and across multiple different topics. You're an academic, you're a thinker. So let's start with the easy one. And Bitcoin in 21, over or under?
Over.
Markets in 21?
Over.
China growth?
Under.
Interesting. In-person events in 21, large events?
Unfortunately, under.
Okay. By the new Biden administration?
Over.
And last, but obviously not the least, alternative investments?
Of course, over.
Awesome. So, Kevin, thanks for being a sport, and thanks for playing. Very interesting, perspectives here. I wanted to end by, asking you to tell where the audience can find you and your new book.
Oh, sure. Thank you. First, let me just say I appreciate the opportunity. I love what you guys are doing at Yield Street, and I enjoy the opportunity to be a small part of your process and your education. My book, it's called Exotic Alternative Investments, Standalone Characteristics, Unique Risk and Portfolio Effects. Type in the title of Exotic Alternative Investments and my last name, Mirabile, and it will pop up on Amazon. So thank you again.
Wonderful, Kevin. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. I remember meeting you a couple of years ago, and really kind of took to the research and the work that you are doing. I look forward to doing it again. And finally, thank you to all of our listeners. Remember to visit yieldstreet.com to learn more about our offering and come to realize your next level with us.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.